Hello and welcome back to Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
What's up, Andrew? I hope you had a good holidays. I put myself through the torture chamber yesterday. I can't lie. I took a 2-hour round trip boat ride so that I could do an 8-mile hike that involved two ascents of 1,400 feet. My legs almost gave out. I drank an entire backpack full of Camelback water. Still thought I was going to dehydrate on this island and have to get, you know, medevaced out by the National Park Service. Thankfully, I'm alive, well, and ready to talk hoops with you.
Thank you. Thank you for that recap of yesterday. When I emailed you to ask about what time, you hit me back, and I was like, I think that's like 6 a.m. California time. And so I honestly thought you were on the East Coast, and then you informed me that you were hiking through, what island was it?
It's the Channel Islands. They're right off the Pacific coast, and it's only like an hour off the coast, but really it's like going back in time. I mean, if you want me to kind of break this down, these islands are like perfectly untouched, protected area by the National Park Service. And for some reason, even though all of Southern California is in a drought and there's nothing green in like a 500-mile radius, these islands are still perfectly green, pristine. You can hike through these beautiful hills and feel like, you know, you feel like you might get, you know, a triceratops like coming around the corner, you know, ready to just kind of like come up to you and ask for some food or something. It's nice. It's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. I have two reactions to this little monologue. Number one, we really need to get you on Instagram because I think the juxtaposition of your life in national parks and your life in depressing media rooms would be fantastic. And I feel like there's a solid audience for that. Number two, I love how different our vacation days are because for the last 4 days, I've done nothing but watch movies on demand and like watch old 30 Rock episodes on Netflix. And I've had a great week too. So we're both fired up. Life is good. Should we get into some questions?
Well, once again, the mailbag listeners and readers absolutely deliver just over the top amazing questions this week. Dozens of them. I mean, we had to pick through.
Every time we do a mailbag, I'm surprised by how good the questions are. So let's jump into it. Number one, Michael Russell asks, where does Warriors-Cavs rank among all-time regular season games? What do you think?
Number one game ever played, period. I mean, we do this historical thing a little bit too often, I think, lately, but you know, there's been a lot of really good regular season games. I don't like that we're asking this question so quickly after we had that insane game in Oklahoma City last year between the Warriors and Thunder. I feel like
that's everything. I think we do the immediate over the top reactions with a lot of these games, but for me, I can't imagine a better regular season game than Warriors Thunder last February. Like I think that's going to stick with me for life, and I'm going to be like lecturing future generations about that game. And then, you know, Spurs Cavs from 2 years ago where Kyrie went for 60, that was great too.
Money.
I have a confession here. The fourth Don't quarter of that game of Warriors Cavs.
Dude, are you kidding me?
So I'm not even really qualified to answer this question. Probably not qualified to host an NBA podcast after admitting that. But yeah, there was a family affair. Like a bunch of us were going to a movie. It was my wife's first Christmas in DC. So I couldn't really like send her on her own. So I had to just sort of bite the bullet and go see Star Wars instead of seeing the fourth quarter of that game.
You know, every time you come on this podcast and explain to me why you didn't watch a game, it always sounds like a shoplifter, like a shoplifter trying to tell a cop why he had to steal like $15 worth of food. It's like, look, we don't really care about the story. Like, come on, man.
I made up for it by watching Sixers Kings like a night later. So it's fine.
A few things to react. I was about to say the good news about our Christmas breakdown is we waited like 4 days, so we should have had the proper perspective to kind of put this game where it stacks up historically. But it doesn't matter. It could have happened 3 years ago. You wouldn't have seen it, so who even cares?
Well, so I have a question for you from a listener. George Frazier asks, were the Warriors careless down the stretch against the Cavs, or were they trying to humiliate them with Globetrotter passes and circus plays? Why so the horrible hero ball shots with no ball movement in final clutch possessions?
So you just said that you shouldn't watch, you shouldn't host a basketball podcast, but you should, because that was a beautiful segue, because you knew I was about to keep railing on you for not watching the game.
Yes, exactly.
So you brought up the Warriors late game issues because you know I cannot resist crushing them every chance I get. Well, look,
right.
Real quick, going back to Michael's question, though, it's the best Christmas game I can remember in a while. You know, there hasn't been a lot of great Christmas games, so we got to put it up there. It was really hyped, and I thought it delivered on the hype pretty much fully. So let's put that question
to the
side.
Christmas games in general are always pretty brutal, because I will like gather my family around to watch basketball with me, and then they're always just like the most lifeless games, usually blowouts. And so I'll have family members being like, so this is it, huh? Like, this is your sport, right? And it's always tough to explain. So I appreciate Warriors Cavs delivering, but like the first three quarters I saw were great. And then it looked like the Warriors were going to pull away. And then see, there's another segue for you. So take us through the late game issues.
Well, I thought for the first 47 minutes of the game, so that includes the 36 that you watched, Kevin Durant was the best player on the court. I thought he was a really strong performance from him in terms of, just looking comfortable, getting his spots, getting wherever he wanted. And then in the last minute of the game, he completely fell apart. And the final three Warriors possessions, you know, the third to last one, Durant gets beat to a loose ball by Kyrie Irving, kind of a weak pass from Iguodala. But, you know, Irving just flat out beat him to the ball. I mean, what's KD doing? Kind of nonchalant, you know, going for it. So I kind of hold that one against him. The next possession, they bring it up and they're really looking to kind of milk the clock, get a good shot. But Iguodala can't even get the ball to KD because he can't get open because Richard Jefferson's all over him for 20 seconds in the shot clock. They wind up kind of waiting, you know, late into the clock. Iguodala kind of gives it to Draymond Green. Draymond's attacking off the dribble from the three-point line. Not exactly what you want to have happen as your bailout option. He gets it to Clay, who hits a three, but it's too late, so it doesn't count. So again, the Warriors, you know, late game offense kind of bogs down, primarily because KD couldn't get open, and that's who they were looking to kind of force feed. And on the final play of the game, you know, he gets tripped, he gets bumped, but again, he's looking to try to score in isolation one-on-one again. It doesn't work. He doesn't get the call. I think he probably should have gotten the call, given that he's the second best player in the world. But you add all of that up, and that's a really, really bad final minute for KD, especially when we're all talking about, does LeBron own Kevin Durant? Is he finally going to be the piece that kind of gets the Warriors back over the hump against the Cavaliers? And instead, he reverted to a lot of, you know, the old bad habits from the Thunder days in terms of my turn, your turn stuff. And the Warriors got away from their strong offense, which is move the ball, keep everybody moving off the ball, see maybe you can get some easy stuff going to the hoop. And they just didn't have it late. Plus, there was the complacency factor. And you know how I hate the complacency stuff.
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing, though. I don't want to overreact to that. Like, KD still had 36 and 15. I am actually more interested, as far as the Warriors are concerned, I'm more interested in what's going on with Steph. Because it's not really a small sample size anymore. Like, for the last month, he's been shooting, I think it's 36% from three. And for the last 2 years, he hasn't really played well against the Cavs, which is an issue because it's basically them and the Cavs, like they are in their own league. So like I'm more interested, and I also, the other thing that I wonder about is whether the Warriors are going to have enough close games to figure out like a healthy balance between KD and Steph. Because I mean, when you're beating teams by 15 points every night, like it's tough to get a rhythm in those crunch time situations.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a legitimate question. And did they learn nothing from last year's postseason? You get up against a good team, you have a big lead, you're cruising. Why do you take your foot off the gas pedal? Why don't you continue to trust the offense? And when things start going south, who's going to step up and save it? I mean, those were the big questions we came away with last playoffs. Remember, I kept calling them the talented, you know, the A student who kind of rushes through the test and doesn't.
The answer was Steph all of last year. And then he was sort of banged up down the stretch and he wasn't the same player anymore. And he's not the same player now. So, I mean,
Yeah, again, let's be real. Kerr and Curry both said after that game or in the immediate aftermath that they need to do more to kind of figure him out, right? Get him more involved or whatever it might be. And so if I'm a Warriors fan, am I really that concerned about a loss to the Cavaliers on Christmas? Well, probably because it probably ruined. But I think it ruined their holiday, though. I mean, that's a lot of trash talk coming from Cleveland after that game in terms of their fan base. But I don't think they should be worried in terms of, are they still on track for the finals? Obviously. But yeah. These kind of things like plant a seed mentally, you know, like KD has had some issues late in games in crucial moments. And it can't be KD versus LeBron. It has to be the Warriors taking down the entire Cavaliers. I don't think KD versus LeBron is going to happen this year. I think he can
guess so.
I don't know. I mean,
my takeaway would be that, like, if I were a Warriors fan, I wouldn't be that worried. But I will say, as a basketball fan, it's so much more fun when the Cavs are right there with the Warriors. Because, like, when Golden State was starting to run away with things, I mean... Granted, I was walking out the door to go to Star Wars, but I was like, man, this, like, it's just more fun when this is like a real rivalry. And it only, like, Golden State is going to have the advantage in every single game they play. And speaking of which, next question. One of the things I like with these mailbags is every now and then the main SI account tweets out like our solicitation for questions. And so you get some real hot takes from the mainstream internet. So Steve Ortega asks, why does the league and the refs baby LaQueen James trying to make a basketball player out of him? Second rate. And let me say one thing. Like, obviously, that's the like quintessential hot take from a Twitter egg. But yo, the refs in the first three quarters, even before the Richard Jefferson thing at the end, the refs were really favoring the Cavs in that game. Like, every 50-50 call went to Cleveland. There were a couple times when Golden State was making a run and the Cavs were sort of whistled back into it. So that is another reason I would not really worry too much. It felt like kind of a fluky game from the refs. And if I were a Warriors fan, I would be like, you know what? Like, all things considered, every single thing went right for the Cavs.
Yeah, I guess it would be easier for you to sell me on that if they hadn't blown a 3-1 lead where everything went against them three straight losses. I do think, though, I mean, that technical foul against LeBron that was not called, I mean, that had to be called. And they came out and admitted it after the fact. But that's like the absolute textbook. Like, why do you even have this rule if you're not going to call it in that situation? And I understand the refs, you know, they're probably overwhelmed by the moment. Christmas Day showcase game, you know, the two teams everybody wants to see, the biggest star in the league, pumped up home crowd. You know, you're going to be basically, you know, taking beers to the face from the angry Cavaliers fans if you make that call in that situation. But you have to do it. That's your job. That's what you're getting paid for. So I can understand why there'd be some frustration there. But still, despite the weird calls that you're mentioning, despite the technical foul that wasn't called, despite the no call for KD on the final possession, that's still a game that Golden State should have won by 10 to 12 points. And to me, you can't put yourself in a position where Kyrie Irving can close you out with that Mamba mentality, because that guy is just waiting, living to do that. And, you know, he had a great closing stretch. I mean, we should probably give him a little bit more credit than I have to this point. I know you didn't watch the fourth quarter. That's fine. But no, Kyrie was pretty good down the stretch.
I wrote about it before the game. I said, look, like, the Warriors are pretty much impossible. And the only way that the Cavs win this game or win any of these games are if Kyrie goes nuts. Because, like, LeBron is kind of like a baseline as a triple-double, and Kyrie is more of the X factor for them. And something like, look, when he gets really hot, like, no one in the league can deal with him. And that's a whole other subject. Kyrie has become sort of polarizing on his own, but, like, he has a gear that makes him more unstoppable than anyone in basketball, particularly in those ISO situations at the end of games. So it's not surprising that he played well down the stretch and Cleveland was in a position to win.
For sure. I mean, look, but Golden State shot themselves in the foot with Ralphie's BB gun. Kyrie just finished the job. I mean, that was definitely a gift, like Klay Thompson said. And they cannot run from this. They cannot sweep this under the rug. This is a real thing. And you've got a great...
You're always out for accountability. I love it.
Oh, for sure. But also, your point about how many chances are they going to get to have those kinds of tests is a great one. I mean, they're only going to see Cleveland one more time.
Yeah.
We look at this Western Conference playoff race. I think there's seven pretty good teams in the West.
They beat the Jazz by like 30 the other night. Like it's
bingo.
I mean, tough to find like a real game for them. Yeah.
So do you start using the end of second quarters to like practice your plays? Like, you know, like what do you do? Because you can't just keep guys in for four quarters. I don't know. I think if I was a Warriors fan, that was the single worst possible outcome on Christmas. And that's tough.
Well, all right. One more question here on Warriors Cavs. This is a frequent topic of debate on sports radio, etc. T Dave asks, do you think NBA popularity would go up in a world where Golden State and Cleveland's top stars were distributed to non-star teams? And I will just say that, honestly, I don't think there's any problem in the NBA. And all you need to do is put Kevin Durant on like Boston, or put him on Houston or Washington. Like put him with another two or three stars, give us one more contender, and we're set. Like the NBA really only needs three or four contenders, or put Draymond on the Raptors. Like that would be fine.
Yeah, I really don't think just completely spreading the talent out across 30 teams would be a good idea for the NBA. I tend to agree that the top heavy approach works best. Lots of people within the league seem to favor that thought, even if their players aren't on that team, or if they're not part of one of those teams, they all kind of feel like, look, we need some super teams to really, grease
the
interest.
Game.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is though, and you've identified it, the gap between the first tier, which I think right now is basically two teams, and the second tier is just too wide, right? Like San Antonio, do we really believe they can take Golden State out? Not without some serious help. Toronto, I mean, we've seen what happens to them every time they play the Cavaliers or the Warriors. They give up 120 and it's over, you know, pretty early. So I think the easiest solution here is a team like Boston or a team like Toronto just get super aggressive at the trade deadline. That is what I want in 2017, almost more than anything else for the league. Like I want a Paul Millsap to get poached. I want one of these other guys on teams who are like, you know, third or fourth tier teams. I want one of those superstars to join up and make one of these second tier teams better so they can have a real kind of fighting chance in the postseason. That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah, I just kind of get bored and annoyed with some of the people who say like the NBA's system is broken. Look at the Warriors and Cavs. Like this league doesn't make sense. This league doesn't work. Like no, like the system actually has worked great. It just is a matter of like this past summer was such an anomaly. And there, they really, the league and the Players Association really did screw up by not agreeing to cap smoothing that would have prevented something like this. But like, again, like if you put KD on a different team, we're in good shape. Or have him stay in Oklahoma City with Russ, like that, again, like that would make for a crazy rematch in the Western Conference Finals that I think like all of America could support. So I think it's fine. I think this is going to be a weird few years with the Warriors, and then it'll be interesting to see where things go next. So, but we should move on. Another question here from Mega Lutu: is Boogie Embiid the best matchup ever? Is it time to have bigs in the All-Star 3-point contest? The Boogie Embiid vine the other night is probably my favorite NBA vine of the season thus far.
That's the first time enthusiastic spanking in a vine hasn't been X-rated. I mean, that's...
yeah, the spanking vine was fantastic. Shout out to Joel Embiid. A friend, Spike Eskin, said Joel Embiid is the first person to make Boogie likable. And that's the most impressive... accomplishment of Embiid's season thus far. And
well,
it's
I think
really
it,
true,
it really it turned his whole mood around, because I think like the next night or maybe two nights later, Cousins brokered a peace treaty with Myers Leonard, and they had respectful things to say about each other in post-game handshakes after a game in Portland. So I mean, this could be the dawning of a new Boogie age, all thanks to Joel Embiid.
It was a pretty brutal month of Boogie, but Embiid helped him turn the corner.
But the bigger thing here, though, was his point about the 3-point contest, right? Like, do you want to have bigs in it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a no-brainer. First of all, like almost every great big man in basketball shoots threes now. So outside of Rudy Gobert, like put Gasol in, put Embiid in. I think Embiid's shooting like 45% from three. Boogie, Anthony Davis, Karl Towns. I think that would be great. My reaction to that, though, was honestly like I wish we had done this 15 or 20 years ago with like the big men who didn't shoot threes. Like I want to find out. I think Akeem probably would have been money from three. Shaq, not so much, but I would have loved to see him shoot 33s. And David Robinson, like that era would have been fun.
Well, see, I had a similar thing with the history angle, except, I mean, a three-point contest, the way it's set up now in 2016 just seems so quaint, you know? Like, I can understand why all these racks of balls and, like, the money ball would have been, like, really cool in, like, the late 80s and the early 90s.
Yeah.
But the game is just so different now. I mean, we see a better three-point contest on any given night when the Warriors are playing or where Damian Lillard's hot or when Kyle Lowry's got it going or Kyrie's, you know, shooting it from deep. So to me, they got to reimagine this entire three-point contest. I don't know if that means bringing in bigs. I don't know if that means adding a four-point shot, maybe a logo shot. I mean, the shooting stars, that doesn't really work, right? Like it's kind of hokey. It didn't quite work. But can't we supercharge the current three-point contest format to maybe add a little bit more creativity and a little bit more distance to this proceedings? Because just sitting there on the short porch, you know, money ball three from the corner, I don't know, man. It just seems like it seems like watching a layup contest, you know? Like, cool.
All right. Look, I don't think we need to change the three-point contest that much.
You're going to be the traditionalist. I can't believe it.
I don't like to change. And here's a solution. We can have your, like, extreme Mountain Dew three-point contest where people shoot from all over the floor, but keep the regular three-point contest the way it is. I do think that we really do need like a big man division of the three-point contest. Like just give us one segment where it's like Karl Towns and Embiid going head-to-head for 20 minutes or whatever it is. So
I like the bigs in the skills contest though for the same reason, because now you're getting to see everything that they can do. I mean, you could have an entire skills contest now with guys who are like 6'11 and taller, and that's crazy. Like that's really insane to think about.
Yeah.
If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out the MMQB's 10 Things podcast.
Rex comes in, hasn't gotten his own guys there. They had no first-round pick in 2015. Their top two picks this year both get hurt. The expectations for what this team was going to do in 2 years, and the fact that they might win 8 or 9 games, to me, is an accomplishment.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of the 10 Things podcast wherever you download your shows.
All right, next question. Hey, Mr. Kane asks, when watching League Pass, which home broadcast team should I be looking for? Local broadcast power rankings? Another broadcast-related question here from Brett Hoy. Who do you guys think is the saltiest game commentator in the NBA? Now, probably watch more League Pass, so I'll defer to you on these.
Well, the best, I think, it's not going to shock anybody. I mean, you start with the biggest market, New York, and you've got Breen and Clyde. I mean, that's basically an unstoppable duo.
Yeah.
And you've got Ian Eagle with the Nets. And the downside is you have to watch the Nets. The upside is you're going to have a great audio experience. I rate the broadcast guys based on the play-by-play guy, not so much the color guy, just whether I like his voice or not. As somebody with I have a pretty annoying voice. So I wouldn't want to necessarily listen to myself 82 times a game, 82 games a year. But like Joel Myers down with New Orleans, you can look at that Minnesota broadcast crew, Dave Benz, Jim Pete. I mean, those guys are dropping knowledge. I think Calabro's got a pretty good voice, the new guy in Portland. So those are some of the guys I would kind of give love to. In terms of the saltiest, two names jump out, both former players. One, it's a national guy, not a League Pass guy, but Mark Jackson's got to be the saltiest commentator in any sport anywhere, right?
That's a great point. I wasn't even thinking national, but yeah, I don't think there's any question that Mark Jackson is atop the salty power rankings.
I mean, he said that Steph Curry was bad for basketball. Like that, I think that's basically the saltiest statement, regardless of the context, you could ever utter. And then Sean Elliott, to me, is also, he gets pretty salty. I think he really grates on some people more than he actually grates on me. Maybe I've just developed a tolerance, but he's so indoctrinated.
He grates on people, yeah.
Yeah, but I think I've developed a tolerance to it just because he's so indoctrinated in the Spurs way of doing things. He understands, you know, Pop's philosophy front and back. Obviously, he is very one-sided. So if a call goes the wrong way or if a player screws up his assignment, you know, whether it's offensive or defensive, Spurs or otherwise, he tends to let, you know, pretty good doses of salt through.
Yeah, so I will just, most of the games I watch on League Pass, I watch with the sound low. So I don't really pay attention to the broadcasters. I will say that two that I really like are the Bucks. Marcus Johnson is great. And then every now and then you get Gus Johnson kind of moonlighting for them. And he's fantastic. The Grizzlies are also great. Love my hometown Wizards and Steve Buckhantz. I will also say, like, a pet peeve of mine with some of these broadcasters is that, like, the homerism just goes, like, over the top to where they are referring to superstars by their first name. Like, if it's the Rockets guys, they'll call Harden James. So it's like James on the drive, and it reminds me of when the Sunday Night Football guys call Ben Roethlisberger Ben, and it just sort of like creeps me out. And so that's basically my biggest objection across the league is that there's just the homerism is too over the top, and so I prefer to watch them with the volume down low, and that does not answer the question whatsoever. But that's my take.
No, it makes sense. It really bothers me when people will refer to superstar players by their first name. And sometimes they'll do that in press conferences too. And you just wonder, like, from the superstar side, sometimes they know who that person is so that they could, like, name check them back. But, like, if you're on a first name basis with someone who doesn't have any idea who you are, that's a really bad look.
Yeah, it's kind of off-putting. That's all. I don't know. But yeah. So next question here. J-Mo's thoughts says, should I spend my Christmas money on a pair of new kicks now, or should I wait until next November for the Delhi ones? Man, I'm pretty upset that the Delhi ones are not releasing until next November. I think it's pretty unfair for, I actually don't even know who makes that shoe, but for them to announce that Delhi has a signature shoe and then make us wait 18 months to purchase it is bullshit.
Well, they're getting the very best Australian cows and sheep lined up for the leather and the wool inserts, I'm sure. No, here's the thing, though. Why did they release an awesome commercial with Delhi cast as like a combination of like God, Jesus Christ, Michael Jordan, and Kobe? And then they're gonna make us wait however long it's going to be until they come out.
Did you see the commercial?
Oh, of course I saw the commercial. You emailed it to me 7 times in a row, Andrew, in like 5 minutes.
I'm just making sure you watched it because it is literally, it's like a minute and a half of Delhi monologue about what it takes. And like, that's it. It's him talking over an empty basketball court.
See, the monologue makes him sound like Forrest Gump and the video makes him look like Jerry West. So that if that is what you're looking for in a shoe, Delhi's got it for you.
It's great. Next question. I actually wrote about this week, which Eric asks, which teams in the middle of the pack East will still be there come playoff time?
I love that we got this question from Eric because I wanted to know like what the heck your takeaway was from digging into that and writing about it, because I'm just tempted to say I trust no one ever in that pack and just leave it. Like, is that the right take?
Yeah. So I wrote about how inconsistent some of the teams in the East are and how closely clustered everyone is. Basically, there's 4 games separating the
everyone.
3rd seed and the 12th seed in the East. So the Magic and the Celtics at the time of publish were separated by 4 games. And now I think it's a little bit more separate, but still, it's just a toss-up. And the easy conclusion is, and I got this a lot in Twitter replies, is that the entire East sucks. And I don't think that's necessarily true, because I think there are actually some fun teams. But yeah, it's definitely like, I think this is the other side of parity, where you see like results are a little bit more random and their stars are equally distributed, but like the rest of the teams aren't that great. Or you have teams like the Hornets where they have a lot of like solid pieces, but there just isn't that much firepower. Like when you're counting on Cody Zeller, there's going to be some limitations. The teams that I really like though, I think in terms of just trust, I trust the Celtics. I trust the Bucks because I just feel like Giannis is blowing up and I don't think that that's going to include like a disappointing 35 win season. And the Knicks, Porzingis and Melo are so good. And the same with the Wizards. Like if Wall and Beal are healthy, they have stars that some of these other teams don't have. Like the Hawks have just been miserable this over the past like 6 weeks.
See, that's the thing. Whenever I get a question like this, I always do the process of elimination. And the problem is when I started thinking about it, I basically just eliminated everyone.
Most of the Eastern Conference playoffs.
Yeah. No. So I didn't trust the Hawks for sure, just because of what you just mentioned. And I mean, chemistry, 3-point shooting, all these things that were positives a few years ago have just completely disappeared.
Yeah.
It's hard to trust the Bulls because they look like a different team every time they step on the court. Very hard to trust the Pacers because, I mean, no matter how many guys they trade for that are offensive-minded players, their offense still sucks. It's hard to get excited about the Magic or the Pistons. I mean, I feel like we've been waiting for the Pistons to come on here a little bit. Hasn't happened. Do you really trust the Hornets, you know, kind of, you know, top three guys in the playoffs given what happened last year, how they kind of fell apart to a fairly mediocre Miami team? I mean, obviously you trust Kemba, but guys like Nicholas Batum,
but like
Marvin
Batum
Williams
has kind of come back to earth this year. I think he's shooting like 39%, 33% from three. Not ideal.
I definitely don't trust the Knicks, no matter how good Porzingis has been and how well he's kind of balanced.
I
kind of
ran
Melo
into this as I was writing it. I was like, I could bullshit about why I don't trust the Knicks and try to come up with some real reasons. But like the honest to God reason is that a lot of the Knicks season feels a little bit too good to be true. And I feel like something bad is going to happen.
For sure. So that leaves
I don't trust the Knicks because they're the Knicks.
So that leaves me with three teams, the Celtics, the Bucks, who you mentioned, and the Wizards, who I think you also mentioned, as being like the last of my batch of teams that I don't distrust, if that makes sense. I think the Celtics are still, their record is not as good as they are. I still have faith in them now that Crowder and Horford, and they have the potential to swing a deal at the deadline. So I think that that's a team that I would say I definitely trust to have a strong chance to win a playoff series. Milwaukee and Washington are both teams I think have a chance to push up the standings and potentially win a series this year. But I wouldn't necessarily bet on it. I do like Washington's starting lineup, and they seem like they've come together. For a while there, it just seemed like everyone on the Wizards hated each other. And I feel like maybe sometime in mid-December, they just realized, like, look, we're stuck with each other until April. So let's just make this work and go with it.
This dovetails nicely into another question we got from Sir Ah. How do you feel about the Wizards' playoff chances? And from Will Gong, is it time to believe in Otto Porter? And is it better or worse if he's good? I am like weirdly bullish on the Wizards right now, despite how depressing some of our Wizards exchanges have been over the course of the season. Like you said, like the starting five is really, really solid. I know that Bradley Beal has never been healthy for a full year in his entire career and is currently nursing a sprained ankle. And yet, if he can stay like mostly healthy, they will definitely make the playoffs. And that's a scary thing to say out loud. I'm knocking on wood as we speak. But like they're super talented as on the starting line. The bench is shockingly bad. Like there are four or five players who just don't. Jason Smith, Marcus Thornton, Tomas Satoransky, Sheldon McClellan, like people, Ochefu, who like legitimately might not, it wouldn't shock anybody if you told them they weren't in the NBA and they're just like borderline guys. So like there are definitely holes, but it seems like they've actually kind of turned a corner with Scott Brooks, which is another thing where like, if I were an objective NBA fan hearing a Wizards fan say that, like I'd be like, man, that guy is pathetic. but I really believe it, and that's all that matters.
No, that didn't really sound pathetic. And again, we're not talking about the highest bar here, right? Like, they're basically right around 500.
They're not turning a championship corner, but they,
if they go two or three games over 500, like, all of a sudden, like, they're sitting in home court practically.
The point is, Scott Brooks knows what he's doing to a degree that Randy Whitman absolutely didn't. And it's starting to make a difference.
Well, one thing I'm really glad about is that John Wall has turned it up. I mean, that to me is a big deal. And to go back to that guy's question, Otto Porter's got to be in the most improved player conversation. He's not going to win it because Giannis has already got the trophy, you know, in his grasp. But Otto Porter has been a much different player this year, much more effective player. And he's a big reason why that starting lineup is working. You need a guy like him in that group with what he brings to the table on both ends. So,
yeah, no, he's been really, really solid. It's going to be interesting. Like, I am pretty pretty stressed about what his contract will be and what it will mean for like the long-term future of the Wizards. Cause his agent is David Falk, who repped Michael Jordan. And obviously things with Jordan did not end well with the Wizards. And Falk has just always had beef with the Wizards. Like he openly trashed John Wall to the Washington Post a couple times. So like, I don't think there's any way that Otto hits free agency and doesn't immediately demand the max.
Well, and I think if you're the Wizards, like you're not, as an organization, you're not in a position to like say, oh, is this guy who's like pretty close to a max player or earning himself in that kind of a conversation worth it or not? Like you just have to do it. You have to pay him and it sucks. And you wish you didn't have to, but you know, your alternative? What's your alternative, really? You're going to let him go, you know, to somebody else, and now you're going to try to plug another hole with your amazing bench players that you just kind of listed off. Yeah, it's interesting, though, because you really have not enjoyed the Otto Porter experience this year because you've dreaded so much the thought of paying
him. I'm so conflicted. I've repped so hard for Otto Porter over the years, and now on the one hand, it's validating, and on the other hand, you're like, oh, my God, so we're going to just pay $300 million to John Wall, Bradley Beal, and Otto Porter. And that's the plan. But
yeah, you're at the steak dinner and you're mid steak and you're just so frustrated about the idea of having to pay for it at the end of the meal that you can't even enjoy it.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm not going to let this ruin my dinner. honestly, the vibes around the Wiz are actually like pretty positive right now. So hopefully this little exchange doesn't screw it up.
If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out the Seth Davis Podcast.
Hall of Fame sports writer Dave Kindred. He's written about everyone and everything, including the greatest, Muhammad Ali.
He's in bed. He raises up the sheets and says, get in. So I did. And interviewed him under the sheets, covered up like a couple little kids hiding from their parents.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of the Seth Davis Podcast wherever you download your shows.
Hey, I've got a whole nother batch of questions here from our number one listener, Gus. Did you see how many questions Gus sent in?
I loved Gus's questions. I don't think we could answer like more than a couple today, but we were definitely, he hit us with a bunch of solid ones.
Hey, great news, Gus. You're now our NBA editor. You know, if we ever need some content ideas, we're turning to you. But Gus's best question I thought was, if Kyle Lowry is 6'7", would he be the best player in the NBA? And then who else would benefit from a growth spurt the most?
Okay. I guess there are two parts to this question. Number one is Lowry. What do you think?
Well, I actually think Lowry is almost perfectly proportioned. And we're going to get really deep into the anatomy discussion here, I have a feeling. But he feels like he's perfectly proportioned for a point guard, right? Like, he's big and strong for his position. He can shoot the three. Like, if you give him a bunch more size, how does that necessarily change his game for what he's excellent at, which is being an on-ball defender and then being a very creative playmaker, both for himself and others? I mean, I feel like he's already basically the perfect version of Kyle Lowry. And then you have to wonder about like the personality change, right? Like, if you're a 6'7" guy, does that change who you are?
That's where I fall in. Like, I feel I love Kyle Lowry specifically because he's undersized. Like, what is he listed at? he can't be more than 6 feet in real life, right?
That Let's sounds right.
And basically, his small man complex, yeah, he's listed at 6 feet, which means he's actually like 5'11". His small man complex is like part of who he is. He's just kind of an ornery point guard from South Philly who will kick your ass. And that I want him to be that player no matter what. So I, while I grant that, like, with his skills, if you gave him another 6 inches, like, he would be great. But I don't know. I think maybe he wouldn't have turned out this way if he were that gifted.
That's a great point. I was actually even going a different direction with the personality thing of just being like, he's a pure point guard, right? Like, he's kind of this modern NBA version of a point guard. Obviously, he can score. He's not pass first like John Stockton, pure point guard, but he's what I would consider to be a very traditional one. And now you get into all these positional questions if you make him 6'7", where it's kind of like what the Bucks are dealing with Giannis, right? Like, do you cross match? You know, how many shooters do you surround him with? Who's going to guard opposing teams' point guards? So it's almost like the Ben Simmons phenomenon too, right? Where what position does he play in Philly? I kind of like a point guard who's just a point guard, you know?
So,
and a point guard who's just a point guard, and he can guard either guard position because he's tough and strong. I don't think he needs to be 6'7".
And a footnote to this conversation, Kyle Lowry is kicking ass right now and has been like on an MVP level for about 6 weeks for the Raptors. And I mean, obviously there are a lot of great players, and he maybe is not like as purely talented as people like Chris Paul or whoever, but like, no one is getting more out of their talent than Kyle Lowry over the past 6 weeks.
So it really ticks me off that you said this, because I was going to try to balance the quote unquote slander of DeRozan from the last 3 months on this podcast.
Try to win back Canada.
I was going to try to balance it with some serious, like, shameless pandering on behalf of Kyle Lowry's skills. I think Kyle Lowry is a top 6 or 7 MVP guy at this point.
He's going to be a really interesting contract this summer.
Oh, for sure. I think he's an all NBA second team guard right now.
Yeah,
I think if you did it on merit, I think he'd have to start the All-Star game. He's been fantastic. But sorry, Gus, we don't want to give him 7 inches. But, you know, Gus's question about who benefits the most.
Part.
Yeah, I was going to say, who benefits the most from a growth spurt? Do you have any thoughts on that one?
I do. I actually wrote down my three ideas. Who would benefit the most? So the first one is obvious. I think if Russell Westbrook suddenly becomes 6'8" instead of 6'4", 6'3", like, he is just a more psychotic version of LeBron James. Like, he's kind of already a version of LeBron James now, but give him an extra 5 inches and he, God only knows what happens to the rest of the NBA at that point. The other one,
that raises an interesting question for me though.
What?
I actually think that Russ should almost be out of this conversation because he's the answer to like every single hypothetical question when it comes to this.
Exactly.
But here is one. How short could Westbrook be and still be a star in the NBA? Let's flip this. Like,
that's really good, actually.
So like, if he was like, Muggsy Bogues was like a legit, like, wasn't he like nominated for the Hall of Fame? Like, not necessarily going to make it, but like, he was like a Hall of Fame finalist. Muggsy Bogues at 5'3". I loved Muggsy Bogues. He is not Russell Westbrook. So I think if you make Russell Westbrook 5'3", he's still a star in the NBA, right? Given everything he does.
I'm not willing to go that far. I do think that like 5'10" Westbrook would be a bona fide god. Like, he would, America would have to like, I don't even know what would happen, but he would just be twice as famous as he is now, worshipped like around the world. And like, that would be a fun dude to have around.
Well, I think you could go shorter than that. I think at 5'6", I think at 5'5", I'm still confident Westbrook is a star type player. His efficiency would be worse for sure, finishing in traffic and so forth. But I mean, just the motor alone, and like, how much he could even do more on ball defense, just harassing everyone at 5'5". Yeah, like, can you imagine pesky Westbrook?
I think that might be a little small. I think 5'10 is about as low as it goes these days. But then again, it's Russ, so who knows?
All right. Well, back to the question of who would most benefit. So you said Westbrook. Who are your others?
Well, no, give me some of yours.
Okay, so I actually had like a group of players I thought would most benefit. To me, it's the combo guards, like the twos, not the ones. But like if you're a legit two, a lot of times those guys, if you're undersized at two, they just struggle defensively. You know, I'm thinking of guys like CJ McCollum, where if you gave them 4 inches, well, number one, they'd be more physical on the ball. So they're getting the free throw line more often. So they're going to be more efficient overall as offensive players. But I just also think that their defensive versatility would really pick up, where if all of a sudden, you know, you could guard like twos, threes, and small fours instead of just trying to guard twos and maybe some ones, I think you would just be so much more useful and like easier to build around. So maybe you throw like a Bradley Beal into that mix, like OJ Mayo.
That's a really good call. Like
OJ Mayo pre-cocaine, you know, or whatever it was with his suspension.
Yeah, look, 6'8 Beal, 6'8 McCollum are two pretty terrifying players.
Studs, right? Because you know they can still ball handle at that size. Like we've got Kevin Durant out here like throwing crossovers at 7 foot, right? So like CJ McCollum is still going to get his shot if he's 6'8". And I just think like that puts you into the Paul George, like Jimmy Butler type mix where you're guarding multiple positions and you're really impacting games, like top 15, top 20 type players.
Yeah. So mine was kind of in that category where I think you take Jimmy Butler, give him an extra 4 inches and make him 6'11". Then he's like Kevin Durant size, but twice as like strong and thick. And I mean, that dude, nobody would have a chance. The other one is Karl Anthony Towns.
Oh.
If you take him from 6'10 or 6'11 and make him like Rudy Gobert size, like Jesus. So,
damn it. I really wish I had thought of that. That's a really good one. Now I'm thinking about like, what if we took Porzingis and made him like 7'7"?
Yeah. That's that's pretty scary to think about. We could really like nerd out and get super pathetic with this question. I think 7'7" might honestly be too big. I think at that point you're kind of like floppy and easily pushed around.
But isn't that what we thought about Porzingis at 7'3" and he's kind
that's
of defied that odds? I'm sure there is an upper limit, but I'm all for just like another Porzingis growth spurt to just
Porzingis
test
also kind of has the Westbrook gene where he like goes hard enough so that he could be successful at like a variety of heights.
Yeah, I think the main takeaways here are let's hope that Porzingis grows and let's hope that Westbrook just like loses a foot. Like, let's just see what happens.
Yeah. I'm in. All right. A couple more questions here. Matthew Liebling asks, what do we have to do to get Wilson Chandler onto the Clippers? I don't think that's going to happen. I've thought a lot about it. I really like Wilson Chandler's game and he's kind of inconsistent in Denver and I'm not sure how happy he is. I think he like left the bench entirely the other night against the Clippers. But like the Clippers don't have anything to trade and the Nuggets have been so reluctant to make a deal. I have a hard time believing that their first deal will be trading Wilson Chandler for whatever like crap the Clippers can throw at them.
What's really cool about this question is that Matthew, he really could have sent that to us at any point over the last 4 seasons. And this would have been a legitimate question. Like, haven't they been trying to manufacture a Chandler to LA trade scenario for like, literally since like 2013 or something like that? It's a big hole for the Clippers. I think it's going to, you know, I think they kind of chose who they're going to ride with, you know, Wesley Johnson and Mbah Mute and whoever they can pick up off the scrap heap. When it comes time to buyout season, I think that's their squad.
What about Caspi, Omri?
Well, I hear he's very available because he hasn't talked to his coach in 3 months.
I think he's really good. He would be an upgrade over what they've been working with. The other idea is Kobe.
Oh, come on. Get out of here.
I mean, look, it's not that crazy. They're already trotting out Paul Pierce's corpse every night. But no, that's just me screwing around.
Okay, I'm going to go back to the Kobe of our mailbag questions, which is Gus, because Gus has more good questions. Gus asks, if the NBA added 2 cities, what are your top picks? So for expansion purposes.
So number one, Seattle. is the easy answer. That's the Russell Westbrook of answer of this one. Obviously, Seattle. They need to get to Seattle. What are your answers?
I'd say actually Fayetteville, Arkansas. You know, I just really like what Oklahoma City has added to the NBA, and I just think they need a good local rival. I'd like to explore the Ozarks.
Look, I know this is one of your jokes, but I was actually at a dinner party last night and people were talking about how great Arkansas is. So I'm in. If the NBA wants to move to Arkansas, I'm in. We can go to some parks together, you and me.
I could hear the air quotes around jokes as you said that with your just spiteful voice. No, I think really where I'm trying to go with the whole joke about kind of middle America is that, you know, when we're going through this list of like Omaha, you know, Duluth, like there aren't a lot of untapped areas in the country. Like we have to rush to the coast, right? Like doesn't that, or like at least kind of, you know, bigger cities that are like coast adjacent. I mean, to me, it's Seattle. I wouldn't be opposed to Vancouver coming back in at all, Vancouver, BC. They're ready for it. And I also think San Diego has been a former NBA market. I mean, San Diego would be a great host for an NBA All-Star weekend. So let's give them a team just so that we can have it there. And, you know, I'm a little biased because that would be driving distance. I also think we should, I also think we can kind of give some love or at least a look to Las Vegas too, right? I mean, why not?
I kind of like Vegas always gets thrown into these conversations. I kind of like Vegas more as like the Switzerland of the NBA, where everybody goes in the summer times. And they will, I mean, I really want them to host another All-Star game there because that was sort of before my time covering the NBA. And apparently things just got really like way too wild.
Yeah, you're into near-death experiences if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. Like let's go down that road again. But no, like Vegas, I like as sort of like the summer league destination where everyone shows up and just gossips all year for 2 weeks.
What do you think about San Diego?
San Diego is awesome. Every time I go to San Diego, I end up liking it more than I expected or more than I remembered. So I'm all for San Diego. My other ideas are like of varying degrees of realistic. London would be awesome, but I think like logistically, I don't think you can ask the Celtics to fly 7 hours to play like a division game.
You know what's great? Remember when Toronto was like, oh yeah, Bruno Caboclo, he's 2 years away from being 2 years away.
Yeah.
We've been 5 to 10 years away from being 5 to 10 years away from being 5 to 10 years away from the European expansion. I mean, I can remember
London
David Stern.
Is not going to happen.
Yeah. David Stern's been saying London for what? Like 25 years?
Yeah, that's a good point. I would also throw in Montreal would be pretty fantastic. I've never been to Montreal, but I've always heard great things. And I think, why not? You know, the other one, Louisville, if we have to pick an American city, Louisville. get John Calipari to coach, could be fun. But my heart is, and you pioneered this last year when the NBA was moving the All-Star game, you said we should host it in Havana. And think you were dreaming too small. I think we need a NBA expansion team in Havana.
Well, that sounds awesome. I mean, of course I'm going to say yes to that. I just thought of something though. How would the Raptors react if Montreal actually got a team? Because they've been like beat up as like they've been playing the little brother card for like 20 years. So we give Montreal an expansion team. What are we going to call them? I mean, who even knows? And the Raptors fans would just immediately shift into elitist older brother mode, like seamlessly after 20 years of being the little guy. I'd love
Civil
to see that.
Civil War in the North. That's a great point. I didn't even think about that.
It'd be Canada's team versus French Canada's team.
I think we either need a second Canada team or we could take it to Cuba and the NBA could just go all in on its progressive image.
Yeah, for sure. Well, anything besides flyover states, I think is what we concluded. I'm going to pretend that Louisville wasn't as serious. Actually, I take that back. Louisville was in the mix a few years ago. I forget, was it for the Kings maybe or someone else? They've got the building there. Obviously, basketball just is crazy in Kentucky, but don't you think it would be really hard for them to just convince people to go to their games when they've got the Kentucky Louisville thing so deeply entrenched? Like, imagine if you're a 28 win team playing professionally in Louisville. Like, what are you drawing at those games?
Exactly, like 8,000? Man. Look, you're making the case for Havana for me, and I appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay, perfect.
Well, that I think should be the takeaway. Any league execs listening to this podcast, please get in touch. We have more thoughts on the cigarette boats.
We gave you 9 great options, and we've got another 19 in our back pocket. Go ahead and give us a call.
Anyways, all right. So we will be back next week. Thank you, everybody, for the questions. Thank you for listening throughout 2016. And anything that we didn't answer today, we're going to answer next Friday. Any final thoughts, Ben?
No, not too much, man. You know, just happy holidays to everyone out there. Happy New Year. I just encourage everyone, please, you know, subscribe on iTunes, rate us, give us the 5-star reviews, you know, write some comments, and thanks for sending in all the questions. We loved it. They've sustained us through this winter period, I've got to say. So it was good chatting, Andrew. I'll talk to you.
All right, man.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.